you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers? I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, you.
Plastics.
I'm going to get some money for you. But if you don't get the President of the United States on that phone, you know what's going to happen to you?
What?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have Russ Winter on the show. Russ, how are you doing?
Perky and caffeinated, to quote Joe Atwell.
Oh, yeah. properly caffeinated. So, Russ, of course, you are the proprietor, I guess, of the New Nationalist website. I've read many of those articles. They're very provocative, interesting stuff. The New Nationalist, what's all that about?
Yes, the newnationalist.net. I think we're just trying to speak truth to power. We do kind of a lot of the same angles that you do. I'm actually a big fan of your show. I listen to a lot of them. And I've even picked up a few story ideas from your show. So a lot of the same. It's just peeling back the onion, a lot of hidden history. And a lot of the history and a lot of things we write about are pretty easily researchable, but amazingly enough, they're not really put out there that much, or they're put out mostly in an obscure way. So the research is possible on a lot of these topics, including the one we're going to talk about today.
So, yeah, you've done this what's called the Sabbatean Frankist or Sabbatean cult that has pretty much functions sort of as a secret society or infiltrating, using the crypto strategy to kind of take over society, subvert it, and use it to its own ends. And this explains a lot of perhaps contemporary stories of elite deviance and sort of financial chicanery and, the crime syndicate, as you refer to it.
Right.
Is what I refer to as the establishment, the crime syndicate. It's been normalized and it's been legitimized to the academic, the academic institutions, media institutions, which are controlled by the crime syndicate. So it's not too surprising that they would create a vast narrative so the vast majority of the public would be unaware of it and stroll along and let themselves be exploited, from generation to generation. So, the Sabbatean cult, you said there's a history there, so let's get into it.
I got my information from a couple sources. One of them is Rabbi Gershom Shloman, and then there's also Rabbi Marvin Antelman. That book is called Eliminate the Opiate. The Shloman book is called Holiness and Sin. And then there's Powell. I can't pronounce the name. It sounds like a Polish name. Maciejko, who wrote The Mixed Multitude. And then there was a chronicle put out in 1823 by Krausner. And then a gentleman by the name of Barry Shamish has written about this topic. So I've kind of delved into that. I can see a lot of work needs to be done on this one. It's hidden history. But it all kind of started out in the 1660s with the arrival of a gentleman by the name of Sabbatia Zevi. And he was a messiah. It was a messianic era. If you look at the history of Judaism during that period, there's constant messianic movements. People just jump on board one after another. Well, this one took off, and he's estimated to have 1 million followers, mostly Jewish, at its peak. But also within the millenarian movement in the Christian population kind of bought into it. And that's kind of a fact that I don't think a lot of people know. What happened is that he inverted morality. He created, it was based on the Zohar and the Kabbalah, and the Schloeman gets into it a lot, and it's a hard read. It's really beyond me to really understand what the religious basis of this stuff is. And to be honest with you, it's just an excuse to sin. That's how I would just simplify it. This is like a bunch of chosen, selected persons who are being exempted from moral law. They say the laws of the Torah no longer are valid. It's supremacist gobbledygook that just gives the sect license to be debaucherous, engage in skullduggery and shitstorms and orgies and incest and pedophilia, theft, and trickery, inbreeding, a lot of inbreeding. So it's just a really nasty group of people that this religion took hold of. And the way Zevi put it, he says, since we cannot all be saints, let's all be sinners. So you created this movement, and Schloeman calls it Luciferianism. That's what he defined it as. And they also referred to...
Yeah, and this is almost like it's because they said the Messiah will come if the world is pure or totally sinful, right?
Yeah, something like that. Some kind of gibberish like that.
So there's some sort of weird process mentality going on here where... You know, you can immunize the eschaton through your own actions.
Yeah, you can feel good about being a really nasty person. Yeah.
Interesting. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, it's do what thy wilt.
Wow, yeah, which is interesting, right, because someone else picked that up.
Exactly.
Is that Philema or something? Yeah, do what thou wilt should be the rule. Should be the law of the land or something. It's obviously it's Crowley, yeah. So that's interesting. Go ahead.
Okay, so it's also described as nihilism on steroids. So without going too much into the little intricacies of Kabbalism, that's how I would process it. That's kind of what we need to know for our purposes in terms of its influence on humanity. It's a threat to humanity, really. So the Sabbatia was basically forced by the Sultan to convert to Islam or die. He was brought before the Sultan, given a choice, and he says, I'll go with the Islam route.
Very practical. Maybe that's why the British picked him. It's very pragmatic.
Well, that's what his followers said. He said, that's very pragmatic, you know. So they adopted really this crypto persona, and this was in Turkey and the Ottoman Empire at the time, and Zevi was in the Ukraine, the Ottoman occupied area of the Ukraine. And there's a term called the Donmans or the crypto Jews that entered into the power structure of the Ottoman Empire. And it's kind of funny because my son actually studied at Bogazici in Istanbul, his graduate program, and he's very much an expert on Turkey. And I was talking to him about this. He said, I said, you know that the Young Turks were crypto Jews? And he goes, what? What are you talking about, Dad? Where do you get this kind of nonsense? And I said, well, okay, yeah, they're called the Donmies. And so he goes, and here he is getting this top-notch education, and he's never heard of this stuff. So he's having some beers with some of his Turkish colleagues at school, and he's asking him about it. And he said, oh, absolutely right. You need to listen to your dad.
That's interesting because I always heard that the Young Turks were it was like a Freemasonic thing. But that, yeah, I can see how that can be confused or interrelated, because again, part of this crypto infiltration thing obviously could be the spirit, or at least the strategy being employed, the same strategy or spirit being employed there.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah. There is a tie-in, as we'll get into. So the question then is, after Zevi becomes this Muslim, did the 1 million followers just disappear? And sort of the narrative kind of holds that it did. It's kind of like, oh, well, they just went away. Everybody got discouraged and they went away. But that's not true. They went underground mm-hmm. for about 80 years. They became kind of a secret society. They were heavy in Turkey, Poland, particularly Lithuania. There was a group of them in Modena and Leghorn, Italy. Prague became a big center for them, and I'll come back to that later because it kind of ties in later to the Rothschilds and sort of the later phases of this. And then they gained traction with the Christian millenarians, if I pronounce that correctly, and with the Murano population, the Jewish converts to Roman Catholicism. And then the richest Jew in Amsterdam, a guy by the name of Abraham Pereira, according to Antelman, was a Zabbatean. So you had some key figures that were operating under this Zabbatean cult. And they basically they held one thing in common besides their degeneracy. They were heralding a destructive arrival of a utopian 1,000-year transformation, and they're pushing for a rebuild of the world, a worldwide compulsory collective, and a total annihilation of any positive system of belief.
Well, that's a theme we see popping up from time to time, right?
Yeah, I mean, would you say communism?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's their doctrine.
It's communism and capitalism.
Yeah, you could say capitalism as well. That's a very good point.
Interesting.
So, yeah, that's what Antelman says. Antelman kind of says exactly the same thing. It's this hybrid capitalism, communism, and this influence of this cult. And there's something about, I don't know, I think there's some advantages to being real sinful, particularly if you're in closed company. So if you have a cult around you and other people operating around you, it gives you huge advantages over other people. And one of the things I've kind of learned in the last couple of years, there's this ridiculous razor. It's called the Hanlon's razor. Are you familiar with Hanlon's razor?
I'm familiar with Occam's razor, but what's Hanlon's razor?
Hanlon's razor is that, do not attribute to malice what you can attribute to stupidity.
Yes. Now I know that. Okay. I know that saying. Yeah.
It's nonsense.
Yeah, I know. It's coincidence theory. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's complete nonsense. Yeah. It's somebody, probably some Sabbatean Francis made that one up.
It's like conspiracy theory, right? When the CIA came up with that term. Yeah.
Right. It says, "Oh, what are you guys talking about? There's not this kind of malice out there in the world. There's no malevolence. These people are just kind of stupid." No, that's not at all how it works. Anyway, continuing on to the story of Jacob Frank. So the movement kind of went underground for about 80 years, and then along comes Jacob Frank, and he lived in 1726 to 1791. He arrived on the scene as a reincarnation of Zevi, Sabbatia Zevi. And up to then, the sect was just kind of simmering under the surface, and he really brought it back. But he was really pushing the idea of world rule. He called it the cult of the all-seeing eye.
Hmm. So, I mean, now we're getting into sort of like the ideas of the Illuminati, the original Illuminati, and right? I mean,
well, they're using the same symbolism.
Mm-hmm. The same all-seeing eye, and we see that in Freemasonry as well, and of course today with the globalism and with total, information awareness, total surveillance, the surveillance state, and these things, CBS, the eye, right? So there you go.
Yeah, it's world rule. What was a central theme through subversion, the cult of the all-seeing eye, and they actually had four godheads, and the final end-game godhead was, incredibly, it was called Big Brother. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. I mean, I'm reading all this stuff and going, my God, somebody's got to get this whole story out.
So George Orwell didn't come up with them himself?
I would really love to know.
Wow.
I mean, again, it's the Quinky Dink theory.
Yeah.
Huh.
That's interesting. That is, yeah.
So at any rate, unlike Zevi, what happened when Zevi was out there is the synagogue didn't really do any pushback. They were the Zevi bunch were terrorists, and there were so many of them that the rabbis just kind of stayed out of the way. They didn't really try to counteract them, just kind of hoped that it would burn out. And every time they turned around, there was another Messiah. So they were really going through tremendous trouble with this messianic movements that are going on. But the Frankists, and by the way, the term Frankist was used later to describe them. It was called the sect of Edom. Does that Edom ring a bell to you at all? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What's the story on that? Anything?
No, I just isn't that harkening back to biblical times?
I guess so.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, that was what they were called. That's what they're called at the time. And Frankism was later invented to describe them as heretics. And the Jewish scholars really nail these guys as heretics. I mean, that's why they've written their books. They're just washing their hands of them. This doesn't have anything to do with Judaism. This is just a runaway group of a sect that's just gone off in another direction. And so that's kind of what they wrote the book back. But I'm kind of more interested in the crime syndicate aspect of how this thing has evolved. So anyway, Frank starts to undermine the synagogue, and he's got shitstorms going on in Poland, actually what's now called more Western Ukraine. What is today Western Ukraine was then Poland before it was partitioned. You know, then Russia basically took this territory over. So this is between 1756, and he had a mass awakening of these Zebedeans, and they started accusing the rabbis and the Jews, local Jewish population, of ritual murder. And started undermining them and creating shitstorms between the Catholics and the Judaic population.
Is this the origins of the blood libel?
Oh, I think blood libel even goes back further than that. Yeah. They were playing on the blood libel. You know, I don't know the accuracy of any of the charges. Who knows? But this is the game the Frankists were playing. And so the rabbis excommunicated the whole lot of them. That didn't happen under Zebedee.
Hey, Russ, can hold on for a moment?
Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay, so we've got the excommunication of the whole bunch of them by the rabbis. And so in 1759, 13,000 Frankists mass converted to Catholicism in Lviv, which is now Ukraine. And within a year, the Roman Catholic Church booted them out for blasphemous conduct.
Oh, the old days.
Right. Not following our rules, boys. Too much of this incest and orgies going on. So they took Frank. I mean, they didn't want to make a martyr out of him, so they took him and put him into some kind of a convent. I don't know, a citadel or something. And he was detained there for 13 years, living a life of luxury, considerable freedom. He was able to hold court there, send messages out. They didn't restrict him at all. And so, but during this period, now this is kind of even where some of the other authors don't really explain it very well. This whole part I'm coming up on right now is, how did this happen? How did these guys get so much power and influence? And so what he did is that tens of thousands of these Frankists dispersed into Central Europe, and they were sent under the under 12 apostles, 6 women and 6 men. And they went out into the world, and they basically practiced, you know, you're familiar with occultist David Berg, flirty fishing. You ever come across that one?
No. Go ahead.
Oh, it was in the 1970s. David Berg had these women that he would send out to seduce men, you know, get them in bed and try to convert them into the cult using sex as a draw.
Well, that's one way to do it, I suppose.
Yeah, and so they they took some of their skills as a cult and aimed high on the social climbing ladder and marriage, and they would target aristocrats and with considerable success.
Yeah, weaponized sexuality. I mean, obviously, that's you know, sex is a weapon, whether it's for blackmail or subversion or just, yeah, it's an old strategy. So
Definitely. These guys were the master of it. And so the ones that couldn't get the, you know, couldn't marry up the social ladder, they just inbred.
Mm-hmm.
So they'd marry their sisters and reproduce their sisters and cousins. And so it created this double or triple lives of constant name changing. And but they hit some home runs in a few places. There was one Frankist by the name of Mayor Arnstein that married into the Wertheimer family. And the Wertheimers were out of Austria and were considered one of the wealthiest families of Europe. So a key marriage. And Antelman stated that they married among themselves. They created these inter-family relationships, just very, very tight-knit families of inbreds, and then veering off to capture an aristocrat here or there. And then they would hold these summer reunions and orgies in Carlsbad. Carlsbad is in the Czech Republic. It's now called Karlovy Vary. So that was a big cult center, as was Prague. So then we come up to the finally Jacob Frank is released by the Russians after they partition Poland in 1773. And he goes to Brno in Moravia, which is present-day Czech Republic, then the Habsburg Empire. And Antelman says that he goes and stays with his brother, and Schloeman says it's his cousin. So there's kind of an inconsistency who this guy was. Mm-hmm. But he's a key figure. His name is Solomon Dobrushka. So I'm assuming that's his brother. And he's a hardcore Frankist who just so happened to hold the potash and tobacco monopoly in Moravia. So he has eight sons. And just to cover the trails of these guys, two of them changed their name to Frey, F-R-E-Y, and became leading hardcore Jacobins in the French Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually guillotined. But another son, another daughter of his, Solomon's daughter, married Israel Honing. Well, Israel Honing is another Jew who holds the monopoly for Austrian tobacco. So some really heavyweight connections going on here.
A lot of wealth and power, yeah.
So, like I said, the main Frankist centers at this time were Prague, Moravia, or Brno, Hesse in Germany, and Poland. They had this big group of retainers and people around them that never worked. It was never clear how they supported them, but there's always plenty of money. And nobody really explains that. But I guess it's just these intermarriages and getting the right connections to do it. Which means that a lot of people were on board this movement, or at least collaborating with it in some manner. And you got guys like Fritz Springmeier. I don't know if this is true or not. I mean, something probably needs to be investigated. The claims that Billy Graham is a direct descendant of Jacob Frank.
That's interesting. The recently departed Billy Graham. That explained his meteoric rise in the 50s. And, you know, he was supported by promoted by the CIA in these things in the 50s. He became sort of the court evangelical to promote Americanism and American geostrategy.
Yeah, where did they pluck him from, right?
Yeah, he just became this celebrity in the 50s. And, of course, in the television era and these things, it was the revival movement of the 50s and these things. And,
yeah. Well, from the normie listening to this conversation here, they're probably just shaking their head. Mm-hmm. You know, we're just not in Kansas anymore, folks.
No. So, it's Fritz Springmeier who, of course, wrote the book with the Bloodlines, the Illuminati. And, it does, it sounds crazy to know a sudden, wait a second, there is some of his research is pretty good on that, these family connections and,
Well, and the Quickie Dink factor.
Yeah.
So you got, next thing you know, Jacob is down. He's been invited to go down to join the court of Maria Theresa in Vienna.
Oh.
And he convinces her that he's running a scam with her, because Maria Theresa was very interested in converting Jews to Catholicism. It was one of her favorite royal projects.
Mm-hmm.
So he was able to convince Maria Theresa that he could help out with that project.
So she's like sort of the gullible goyim? Sort of.
I guess so.
Okay.
So they didn't buy into it for long. They kicked him out because of his conduct. He just couldn't. These people just couldn't behave themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They would get into trouble, shit storms. And while they were there, though, his daughter Eva consorted with the future emperor Joseph II.
Okay, farming his children out for...
Yes,
okay.
Definitely. The son of Solomon, going back to Solomon again, Solomon Dobruska, which I think is a major character that I don't think they really give him enough attention in these books, because he just jumps... His offspring kind of jump up all the time. His offspring is named Moses Dobruska. Got together with some Austrian nobles and formed the Masonic Lodge, the Vienna Order of Asiatic Brethren. Does that one ring a bell to you? The Order of Asiatic Brethren.
No, I just generally familiar with Grand Orient, you know, Freemasonry, the Continental versus the British Freemasonry. But that's interesting.
Yeah, I don't know the meaning of that, but it became a big center of Frankist Freemasonry.
Yeah, I mean, the moment you see a lodge in Freemasonry being set up, your suspicions have to be raised, because these lodges are sort of centers, or at least it's a form of technology for you know, occult communication, networking, and subversion. So, you know.
Right. So Antelman really does dress Masonic infiltration. Mm-hmm. He hits it hard. He says, this is it. This is key to how they did a lot of stuff. My theory is that they were successful. He doesn't explain the method they used, though. He just said, well, they just got into power. They started running these shows.
Well, I think, can we assume it's just money and sex and, you know, human weakness, you know, exploiting human weaknesses. That's, you know, so.
Bingo. Yeah, they provided the vices, the mm-hmm. girls, the booze, and then they could compromise. They had the dossiers on people. And during this period, they also set up a spy network. Well, the other thing that's going on in Europe at this time is, you know, I wrote that article on the Hellfire Club. This is happening at the same time. Dashwood.
Yeah.
And it's the Enlightenment, and it's this whole unleashing of this sort of perverted... It's like people are sort of trying to break out of this medieval church-structured society by kind of going nuts. Kind of like the sexual revolution of the 60s.
Yeah, exactly. It was a revitalization of that. And you sort of had a culture revolution or a sexual revolution in this time, but without the benefit of, or the aid of mass communication and technology, it could never permeate the mass culture. It could just sort of this very narrow elite sect, you know, that had the benefit of wealth. They could transcend the normal concerns of everyday life, which most people eke out a living just to, you know, so they wouldn't starve to death, keep a roof over their head, a thatched roof over their head.
Yeah, they got to have all the fun and all the vice.
Yeah.
And so they set up a spy network, and this is where I think eventually ties into the Rothschilds, because they and there was an investigation done. I'm just kind of getting ahead of myself. I'll get that in a second. Continue on here. So they penetrated the Austrian and German aristocracy with this kind of Jewish Catholic mask with Frankist morals.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the key families was the Van Honigbergs. This is for any of your researchers out there. Von Bienfeld. And the documents have largely been described by the descendants. So it's just hard to get the documentation of these families, but the marriages are clearly there with Frankus. But they've scrubbed a lot of the detail. So Frank died, and Frank goes off to, after he gets kicked out of the court of Vienna, he decides to go up to the Frankfurt area. just right outside of Hoffenburg. And at the same time, there were a number of them in Poland. There's 24,000. Contemporary accounts said there's 24,000 Frankists in Poland after Frank's death. And they escaped both the Jewish and the Catholic authorities. So they kind of lived this life in the middle. By the 1830s, most of Warsaw's lawyers were Frankists.
Some things never change.
And they were also radical politics. They were innkeepers. They ran loan sharking operations. They ran brothels. And they teamed up as henchmen of the Polish nobles. So there's an alliance there, too.
Yeah, that's an old... that's something you see where they kind of form a partnership with the princes and the kings to screw the public,
Work a scam.
Yeah, the same way you saw, like, the Jewish WASP alliance in the 20th century United States with the Rockefellers, and these things,
So anyway, there's conjecture that Adam Weishaupt was a Frankist, but I don't think he was Jewish. I think he was Catholic.
Yeah, he was Jesuit trained. Was not a Jesuit. He was Jesuit trained, and I thought his father was a convert, which I always thought was interesting to me.
That he was a convert.
I might have that.
Verso.
I had that detail wrong. I have the book Perfectibilis, but I haven't read it yet. It's about the Illuminati. It's supposed to be one of the best scholarly works on the Illuminati. The Bavarian Illuminati. I mean, the real history of it, as opposed to the stuff we hear about Illuminati, in Taco Bell commercials and stuff like that. But I don't know if you're familiar with that where you are, but in the States recently, Taco Bell has picked up the Illuminati theme to promote their tacos. So I thought that's interesting.
The Vatican disbanded the Jesuits.
Yeah.
Right. So that group kind of started morphing into Freemasonry as an operating tool because they had a lot of money. I mean, the Jesuits had a lot of power, influence, and money.
Yeah. The story.
They didn't just disappear just because the Vatican dissolved them.
Yeah. The story of the Illuminati is, I think, because Weishaupt was Jesuit trained. He, employed their tactics and their strategy for the Illuminati. The idea of, that's how I understand it. But I always thought it was just Weishaupt. I thought his father was a convert, which I always thought was, you're getting to this, is this a converso thing? Is it infiltrating the offices of the church which we see today, I mean, particularly in the modern era with the CIA and Vatican II, is you don't destroy the church, which the Illuminati wanted to destroy throw an altar. The modern strategy is you subvert throne and altar, and you use those offices to achieve your ends, as opposed to overtly you're trying to take it out because that's going to create too much resistance. You subvert it, and that's, if you look around, that's largely what's being done to subvert these offices. But I'm sorry, but go ahead. You were talking.
I think that's it. So there's some question of who he was, but I think that he probably was Jesuit trained, and even if he wasn't a crypto, they were natural allies.
Yes.
To the Frankists. So there was kind of a tie-in there, and then Weishaupt was apparently working as an agent of Rothschild's. So it fits together.
Yeah, because
the details don't necessarily, but...
Because if you're attending the same orgies, or at least having similar orgies, you're going to have a same, right? I mean, it's going to have the same outlook. Like the Hellfire Club, right?
Yeah, that's what's going on here. They probably had the same proclivities. And they, they're doing the same thing. They're party animals.
Yeah.
So anyway, 1786, Jacob Frank goes to Offenburg, which is right outside of the Rothschild's headquarters in Frankfurt. And then when Frank dies in 1791, they kind of act like, oh, well, the movement just fell apart and disappeared again, just like after when Seve died. But there's an important footnote, and I'm kind of glad I stumbled on this, and I actually found this just a few days ago. Just doing a little extra reading, there was an investigation in 1800 by the Prussians, and they did an investigation by a guy named Chancellor Forney, Forney, who was looking into the sect. And at first he thought the sect of Edom was mostly a scam, but then they switched gears and said that it was a religious sect as cover for political purposes and infiltration. These are his words.
Well, we see that, with today, you know, with the use of cults and religious groups and, you know, using missionaries for intelligence purposes, you know, think of, think of Jonestown.
Yeah.
But go ahead. That's interesting.
That's just, we're not in Kansas anymore. Yeah. You know, the normies have got to get out of their little box. I mean, even I do. You know,
yeah.
I'm just kind of like, wow. Then they go on. He says, the Prince of Eisenberg let the Frankists become a state within a state. This is from the report this guy wrote. So then I just kind of did, let's do a little search of the Prince of Eisenberg and Rothschilds. Just an internet search. And all kinds of things pop up. The Amsel Rothschild was the court agent of the Prince of Eisenberg.
Mm-hmm.
He was giving Eisenberg lots of loans. They were buddies.
Yeah.
So he just let these Frankists come in there. So the theory is our Amsel and Nathan and the Rothschild's families Frankist. When did they become Frankists?
Mm-hmm.
You know, are they part of this whole same network?
And if not officially, in spirit, right?
Well, you think about it. Meanwhile, the Russians and the Austrian authorities are investigating these guys in Warsaw and Poland and some of these other areas. They're calling them a subversive transnational spy network.
Isn't it interesting that these are both a Catholic and Orthodox area that has the balls to investigate this?
Right. The Russians did.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, they hadn't been undermined.
Yeah, it's obviously, you know, that's what's going on. At least that's what it appears to be. So, I'm sorry, go ahead.
So, anyway, just a little footnote. Even Goethe knew about them. He called them a masquerade. He thought they were kind of clownish masquerade because that's how they presented themselves, in kind of a clownish fashion.
You mean like Eyes Wide Shut parties?
Yeah, all that kind of stuff.
The mask.
And so you think about it, you got this network already set up of spies in this Masonic network. And what a natural fit for the Rothschilds' plan of transnational banking. It's just perfect.
Yeah,
Bingo.
It was Nathan who sent his sons abroad, right, to these major cities, London, Paris, Frankfurt, and a city. What city was it in Italy that he went to? All these banking centers.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And they have this whole network already set up through these Frankists who are hardcore, you know, tools.
And also they're bastard children, which again it has a element of crypto too, because you don't know. Apparently, from what I understand, is like August Belmont was a illegitimate descendant of the Rothschilds who came to America to promote Manifest Destiny. Who married, I think, Commodore Perry, who went to Japan, you know, in the 1850s, right, with his gunboat diplomacy. So that these networks sprawl out, and again, we're getting the issue of bloodlines and using these things as sort of a networking, also a reliable way to not only network, but also to spread your tentacles throughout the world.
Well, I have the number here. Let me just look at it and make sure I get this right. Okay, here it is. 29 of 58 of Mayor Amsel Rothschild's grandchildren married first or second cousins. They must have been Frankists.
Yeah, and that's got to have an effect on your genetics, right?
It also really keeps a really tight-knit structure.
Yeah.
You know, you're not bringing in too many outsiders. You know, mm-hmm. You got people that totally get the program. Of course, it also, the inbreeding creates a certain problem, you know, like mental illness.
Yes.
So combine Frankism with inbreeding, and you're probably coming up with some pretty nasty brew there of turning these people loose on the world. And I think there's something to it.
Does it also create hemophilia?
Maybe. So anyway, the next step was that the titular leadership passed to the daughter, Eva, who had seduced the Emperor Joseph II in Vienna. And she was declared the reincarnation of the Virgin Mary. And just when they thought that they weren't going to hear from these guys anymore, they sent out hundreds of red letters to the Jewish communities all over Europe, urging conversion, rebellion, and an apocalypse. And then Eva started to claim to be the illegitimate daughter of Tsarina Elizabeth. Now, I don't know that I believe that or not, because these guys are just liars. Mm-hmm. They would concoct all kinds of stuff. But on the other hand, she spoke fluent French and was a master musician. You know, where does a Frankist girl learn to do that?
Yeah.
She may have been in the court.
Yeah, it sounds like, yeah, obviously in a royal court where, you know, these things would be, you know, she received that type of instruction.
Right. And so then in November 1813, Tsar Alexander rode out to Offenburg to meet her after the Battle of Leipzig.
Hmm.
Why? No, it's just a fact. He went out, decided to take a look at her. Now, is there a connection there, or are we just doing the ultimate hoaxers? I mean, these guys are the ultimate hoaxers. The Hellfire Bunch under Dashwood just loved hoaxes. They loved pulling the wool over people's eyes. Then after Frank's death, the power shifted to an old line family, Sabbatean family from Prague. It had been Sabbateans even before Frank. They had been from the pre-Frank phase. And there are about four or five big families, very, very wealthy Prague families. One called the Wehles, W-E-H-E-L-E, the Bondys, the Porges were out of Venice. So you got a Venice connection there. And the Zerkowitz or Berkowitz family. And they kind of started to change the messaging a little bit. They started talking about liberation from Roman bondage, which is the Catholic Church,
mm-hmm.
and calling for a new Jerusalem where they would rule the roost. So but because they were kind of high upper class members of Prague society, their external moral conduct was totally normal. But behind closed doors, eyes wide shut,
mm-hmm.
necromania, incest. They were very heavy into group masturbating, this whole masturbation thing, which you kind of start, you kind of hear nowadays too among some of these Judaics.
Yeah, and also for understand skull and bones, but that's a,
yeah, right,
in,
right.
In the sarcophagus where you, yeah.
Group sex, permitted theft, and perjury. So behind closed doors, out of sight, these guys were just total wild men. And they were into the liberation of the feminine principle. They worshipped Esther, who was basically disobedient and conniving. That's what Esther was.
Feminism. No.
So to kind of wrap this up, I was going to read this part about this clan. Let me go out up here. Yeah, here it is. Gottlieb Wieland came to the United States with a large constituency of Frankists from Bohemia and Moravia after the revolution in 1848. One member of the clan was Louis Brandeis.
Oh, interesting.
The Supreme Court justice, an ardent Zionist who was instrumental in promoting the Federal Reserve Bank. And then also Supreme Court Justice Felix Frankfurter is reported to have received a copy of Eva Frank's portrait from his mother, who was a descendant of the Prague Frankist family. And then there was another family called the Itzigs, I-T-Z-I-G, out of Berlin that were very powerful. And they kind of married into another powerful Frankist family and controlled the... It's kind of like the head of the Berlin Illuminati is kind of how they're described, and the purveyor of silver to the Russian Royal Prussian Mint, along with banker merchant H. Hiram. During the 7 Years' War, he issued debased coinage that not only contributed to inflation but helped the Prussian government fight the war. These two powerful Frankist families were later joined in marriage. So these guys are operating even really before the Rothschild dynasty took out. So they're already there. They're mm-hmm. already in place. This network is already in place. And then I mentioned before, the Arnstein had married Teresa Wertheimer, the granddaughter and banker of Chief Rabbi Samson Wertheimer of Austria, and Rabbi Wertheimer was considered to be the wealthiest Jew in Europe. He was the financial administrator for the emperors Leopold I, Joseph I, Charles VI, and supervised their diplomatic missions. This earned him the nickname Judenkaiser, or Jewish Emperor. Arnstein, in turn, financed the Tyrolese peasant revolt against France and Bavaria. And I think if you just really started peeling back the onion, you'd see them financing these wars.
He's like kind of a prototypical George Soros or something.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. And then here's the final Rothschild connection. Frank is living in regal style. He had a militia. Nobody, again, how does he get the money? Who's giving it to him? When he established himself in 1789 in the Frankfurt suburb of Offenbach, they were patronized by quote-unquote unidentified philanthropists of the quote-unquote Frankfurt community. But during the Frankfurt Masonic Lodge's formative years, the three most active members of the Frankfurt Juden Lodge were Frankfurt influenced, Sigmund Geisenheimer, Michael Hess, and Justus Heller, who were also leaders of the liberal Jewish reformist movement. Michael Hess was hired by Mayor Rothschild as a tutor for his children. Mm-hmm. Geisenheimer was Mayor Rothschild's head clerk. End of story.
So definitely a network.
Yeah, I think that there's I would love to see somebody like Joe Atwell dig this thing a little deeper, write a book on this.
I mean,
do it, Joe.
That's and of course you have the story of the Rothschilds, their ascendancy occurs at the Battle of Waterloo, where he's able to short he gets advanced information of Napoleon's defeat, and he spreads false information of Napoleon's victory in London, so the market tanks, and he's able to get out, then buy everything in a song, then it shoots up after the real news is reported of Napoleon's defeat, and that's the source of his vast fortune. From then, and the rest is history, because they get into banking, and what really served their interest was the sort of the decadence of the aristocracy, the British aristocracy, and this goes back to the British Reformation, the English Reformation, where the acquisition taking of church property, the dispersion of the monasteries, these things, a few well-connected British families got these vast estates, but they were cash poor. So in the 19th century, they started borrowing a lot of money to build these manor homes, and of course the creditors were Jewish. And throughout the 19th century, these aristocratic families like the Spencers and the Churchills and these things, these families went increasingly into debt to bankers like the Rothschilds. And the Rothschilds leveraged that debt to gradually get control of the British state. Right. In fact, the purchase of the Suez Canal was financed by Rothschilds, and I think I've talked about this before, but there's an account. I was watching a PBS series on Queen Victoria, and this was during the premiership of what's his name? You know, the Jewish Prime Minister.
Disraeli.
And Disraeli was, of course, a friend with Rothschilds, and Disraeli is trying to acquire the Suez Canal, I think, from French investors, I think how it worked out. And he couldn't get Parliament in session to raise the funds, so he goes to Rothschilds to raise the funds. And the account is that Rothschild looked at him and said, well, what do you have as collateral for this loan? And he says to him, I offer you the British state.
Yeah, right.
And that's sort of encapsulates how these bankers get control of governments through debt. And, of course, the experience of the Churchill family, both Winston and his father, they were always, always spending more money than they had, and they were in love with the luxurious lifestyle, their cigars and their alcohol and their manor homes, and they were always bailed out by the Rothschild. And
well, the thing about the system that they set up of banking, which kind of leads a little into the Parasite Guild articles mm-hmm. that I wrote, which I don't know if we can go into today, but they just don't ever forgive debt. It's like they have it's a Judaic religious tenet that forgiving debt owed to a Jew is equivalent to a Holocaust. You know, genocide.
Yeah. Well, that gets, yeah. I mean, you get in some of your other articles that you spell out this networking or this occulted society of Sabbateans and Frankists and getting into finance and getting into banking and through alliances with governments. And governments are always addicted to debt too, because they always want to spend more money than they have or spend other people's money. And this is how they do it, through the bank system. Having a middleman is easy, because when the peasants get angry, they get angry at the at the Jews and not the government. So it's a great way to periodically, you know, hey, I didn't do it, he did it. But
the debt never seems to be forgiven. I mean, in modern times, the two events in modern times that illustrate this was, and this just blew my mind when it happened, because I was following financial markets a lot closer. But when they reworked the Greek debt a few years ago, there's a concept called parsupari. And parsupari is an ancient concept that all debt is created equal. So if you have a bond issue of $100 million, the same issue, then you can't favor one debtor over another.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they did.
Yeah.
They said, no, the central bank, the ECB is not going to take the loss. All you other suckers are. So they haircutted the public or the poor guy's money or the guy at the bank or somebody that owned the Greek sovereign bonds, they haircutted him and made sure that these central bankers or banksters were left whole.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other experience was Argentina. I mean, they just worked Argentina over the coals. Argentina was trying to offer, well, why don't you take a haircut of this amount and that amount, trying to negotiate a restructuring of that sovereign debt, and they were just relentless. The Parasite Guild was just relentless. They just drag them into their courts that they own. These they control the New York courts, they control the London courts where the covenants of the bonds are written, and rake them over the coals and just pretty much extract every pound of flesh they can get out of them. And that's the world we're in right now. That brings us to the present day and the situation that we're facing, because there's an enormous amount of debt out there, and they've established some very bad precedent with this parsupari where they can pick and choose who's going to lose. And I think it's going to be the pensions, that they're going to hit them with big losses. They're going to mark down all these assets in these financial crises. They're going to sweep in with all the money and just scarf everything. That's where your new Jerusalem is going to come from, just a complete Parasite Guild takeover of the world, just getting the assets really cheap and wiping people out. That's my greatest fear.
Yeah, the way they do that, of course, what you're spelling out there is sort of that John Perkins economic hitman model.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the basis of that is debt, and gone is the notion of odious debt, which is a function of, you know, part of international law. Odious debt, where, you know, it's debt is seen as being illegitimate. Because it's a debt that's incurred by a regime for purposes that you don't really serve the people of the nation. And so the people didn't sign on to this debt, these corrupt leaders did. So if you kind of if you were to reinvigorate or reassert this notion of odious debt, that this debt is no good anymore, because one thing, it's a pyramid, we're created by money out of thin air, right? So this is all money that was never saved. It's no one's savings that were put at risk. These are banks that are creating money out of thin air and charging interest on it. And at the end of the day, the bigger banks aren't even incurring any risk. So there's no superficial justification for interest rates in this system. But in the end, you're getting back to the system of usury, which is used to concentrate wealth. And also, it's done through inflation, which is debasing the currency, which is another form of taxation, all benefiting a few bankers and corporations that are at the top of the economic food chain.
Well, there's a great documentary, and I wish I could remember the name. I should have kept a note on this. It might be in one of my articles. I'm pretty sure it is, but it escapes me. It talked about what happened in Argentina. Essentially, they just put a corrupt government in there that just went nuts in the capital markets, borrowing money. and getting Argentina in big trouble. Well, that's the responsibility of these bankers.
Yeah.
You made the loan. You know, you may have put this Yehu in there. You may have controlled him. But you made the loan, and you need to eat the loss. That just seems like a very simple concept to me, but it doesn't exist in this world, in this kind of Rothschildian
Frankist world. Well, because Goldman Sachs is too big to fail.
Yes. You got to make sure they're whole.
Another doctrine. And this whole idea of, remember, the biblical notion of a jubilee every 7 years, right? You wipe the books clean.
But that's kind of a joke.
Yes.
It doesn't exist. It's in there with Hanlon's razor.
Yeah. You know, but the idea is, again, if these banks, again, they've created a central banking warfare model where the banks create money, and literally they create it they create digital money that can be used to acquire real assets, I mean, real physical assets. And of course, if you're getting that money first, you're always going to be in a position to rig the markets to your benefit. And that's why the system was set up the way it was. I mean, that's why the crime syndicate set up the central banking system. It was in the next phase in these things. They could always rig the markets. But yeah, Greece is a great example where, you know, they outfits like Goldman Sachs cook the books to get these huge loans through. So the ECB, it superficially meets the standards of the European Central Bank, you know, the debt ratio and these things. And when they're caught doing that, they're not charged with fraud. No one goes to jail, you know, but Goldman Sachs took its commission and then got this bad loan. And then, you know, next minute, Greece is forced to sell islands in the Parthenon or something to some.
Yeah. Well, they're trying to privatize, and they're actually having kind of a hard time. There's a lot of blowback. Privatizations are just tough to execute. So they may have to come at them again with another crisis.
Yeah.
You know, you have to kind of keep working them over. But yeah, that's a really important point about how Goldman Sachs cooked the books for them so that they could borrow the money. And then when they get into trouble, who gets the passes? These big international banksters. They're kept whole.
Yeah, yeah. And that's an old, I mean, I was reading about the Don Pacifico affair in the 19th century. It occurred around the 1850s, roughly around the same time as the Irish potato, so-called Irish potato famine. But this is the sort of the insidious and evil nature of debt. Well, one thing is much of the British, you know, the so-called potato famine. Well, it was a potato famine because the British had relegated the Irish population to eating potatoes. All the food was exported. So when the famine hit the potato, there wasn't any alternative food source. But at the same time, the British maintained the exports to maintain the interest payments to the bankers, ultimately.
Right.
But at the same time, there's this Don Pacifico affair. And he was this Jewish guy who was a one-time British, renounced his citizenship. I think it was now Turkish or Spanish. But he was involved in finance. He had loaned the Greek government some money, or some Greek creditors some money. And whoever he loaned the money to wasn't making good on the payments. And it's more or less a private loan. And, you know, and somehow or another, the British Navy comes in and threatens to bombard Athens or Greek cities, the Greek king, if they don't pay the loan back. And it turns out that Don Pacifico was a Rothschild agent.
Yeah, I never heard that story.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
At the same time that the British government has claimed that we don't have the resources or the ships to provide relief for the starving Irish, they can send the Navy there to threaten to bomb, you know, Greek cities to pay this gentleman's debt, who isn't even a British subject, by the way, anymore. But this shows you the international cosmopolitan nature of these folks. Meaning,
well, the way they carried it out in Ireland was the same. They just extracted all the extra food. There was food in Ireland to feed people, but it was basically needed to cover the loans and other obligations. And there was a general food crisis, higher food prices around Europe at the time. It was kind of famine conditions generally. So Ireland was like the bottom of the sack. And that's my main argument for nationalism. Because if you get in an emergency situation like Ireland got into, you're going to take care of your own people. Because the same thing happened in Scotland. They had a famine because Scotland had a different system. They had a clan system up there. So the property owners and the people responsible were the kin.
Yeah.
And so they took care of their fourth cousins.
Yeah, and also at the same time, you create dire conditions in a country, then that labor can then be exported. One thing is, you see this in Haiti, and some of the scandals that arose last fall regarding the Clinton Foundation, these things about human trafficking and this exploitation of, which is the ultimate exploitation of human labor, I guess, but also what we've heard about the underground organ transplant trade, these things, how, well, people are more or less being killed for their organs, and if you look at it from a purely economic standpoint, the human body is worth a couple $1 million.
Yeah.
If you look at the price of organs, and so if you're looking at from a Newtonian British view of the world, it makes economic sense to go in, collapse markets, and exploit the resources, which could be the literal bodies of the native population. Even throughout history, it has been. Look at the slave trade.
Yeah, you gotta have your family, and you have to have your kin. Like the Scottish saved themselves from the famine because of that. Well, People don't know that.
Because they had an ethnic identity?
They it was a feudal structure, so you had these wealthy Scots that owned the land, and were subservient to them, but because they had the clan identity and the national identity and the ethnic identity of their own people, they took care of them, even though it meant they didn't profit. They had to pay for it out of their own pocket.
Yeah.
They were the reserves. The Irish didn't have that because you had these absentee British landowners.
Yep.
And the banksters owned everything. And that really hurt them. And people don't realize the importance of a national identity. So once you start breaking that down, then you can run Haiti operations, Ireland operations on all kinds of people.
Yeah, you have quicksilver capital, you have transnational, you know, financing being switched around. You can, and also when you have a moral view or outlook and an ideological or philosophical justification for these things, which is a lot of what the function of the Hellfire Clubs or the Sabbatean cults or Freemasonry is, you have even the whole Newtonian world of where the world is, you know, the universe isn't governed by any teleological purposes. It's all economics. It's all gravity. It's all inertia. You can justify anything just through price fluctuations, cheap labor, right? And think about it is you have to identify coercion properly because they have the ruling elite, the banksters, this crime syndicate has a very sophisticated way of coercing people. They don't necessarily put a gun to your head directly, but if you can go in and you can subvert a country, say, I don't know, ship arms into Mexico and create mayhem, or through NAFTA, destroy Mexican agriculture with subsidized U.S. Corn, and all of a sudden you have a surplus of labor driven off these traditional farms. They come north. They come into the United States to be exploited for cheap labor, disrupt the United States, destroy national identity in the United States, a local identity in the United States through this is weaponized migration. And you see it in Syria. We see it in North Africa, in Libya, and these things, what's going on in Europe. A lot of these factories along the Mexican border are being filled with the surplus labor created by the drug war in Central America and Mexico was directly tied to things like BATF was caught doing, not forward pass, that gun running operation I was exposed a few years ago under the Obama administration.
Fast and Furious.
It was a gun running operation to destabilize Mexico. And they're saying, they're trying to be like some sort of law enforcement act. And and it's funny going back to Ireland is, because of the Irish famine or hunger called the Irish genocide. You had this mass, migration from Ireland into the United States, which was able to fill the factories of the North and fuel the Industrial Revolution in the United States with cheap labor, and also fill the ranks of the Union Army that we went in to crush the South, which is a more traditional society.
The people that are doing this stuff today, maybe they don't even realize they're Sabbatean Francis. Maybe they don't identify as Sabbatean Francis. Maybe they don't even know anything about Sabbatean Francism, but they're influenced by it.
Yeah, they've internalized the values, and that's where
the values. Perfect way to put it.
That's where it's really bad. Yeah, that's where it's most destructive, because that's where you see a lot of these things. Whether And even when in the sexual revolution, the cultural people, or cultural revolution in the 1960s, and really, if you do the research, you see there's real planned malevolence in promoting these things, whether it's feminism, some of the sexual confusion that's been promoted by this, by destruction of the family. And this was figures, you know, as Joe Etwell calls them, lifetime actors, whether if you're a Gloria Steinem, even a Aleister Crowley, these things, these figures are there as put up as examples or archetypes, right, for people to imitate. Now, most people, even celebrities, the promotion of the celebrity culture in Hollywood, these things were done to, these figures are created and promoted to have an alchemical effect on society, or sort of reverse alchemy, debase society. The vast majority of people are not going to imitate Aleister Crowley. They're not going to imitate Gloria Steinem, nor are they going to imitate your typical degenerate Hollywood celebrity. But they're going to internalize enough of their values that's going to have its effect on society. It's going to disrupt society, break up the family, and create, you know, the sort of, the shitstorm, as you call it. They're in there creating shitstorms, because that's how you weaken society.
And then people don't even care about the shitstorms.
They don't even recognize it as a shitstorm.
Yeah, they kind of go, oh, well.
You know, like your typical single mother with two kids from two different fathers, right? And she's just living her life, and she's free. But her kids are in daycare all day, or she's on welfare, or, you know, she relies on public services, and the kids are institutionalized or warehoused somewhere at some state institution. And they don't even recognize the dysfunction, because that's a function of being dysfunctional. It's like, you know, knowing you're, you know, insanity, and do insane people know they're insane? They don't. You know, does a fish know they're swimming in water? And so it's just, that's the function of these change agents, or these figures, these crisis act, or crisis act, maybe it could be that too.
Well, they may be bloodlines. You know, when I first became, quote unquote, a conspiracy theorist, when I hear this talk about the bloodlines, I kind of laughed. Oh, come on, you know. How could you possibly hold together a 10-generation bloodline? You know, I don't even know who my ancestors were 8 generations ago, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's just too dispersed. But we're talking about something different here. We're talking about inbreds, organized around a concept. And so, my God, I mean, I listened to Joe Atwell talk about this. You know, we've got to get in there and figure these people's bloodlines out. That is absolutely right.
Yeah, I mean, this is an organizing principle. This is how you run a multi-generational criminal syndicate. And then we see it, I mean, I don't know, it's character, and we see it portrayed in the mafia. Families meeting, marrying, and they fight among each other. They kill each other, then they forbid, you know, out of pragmatism, they sort things out, and they get back to work, and they start making money again, start earning, as they say. When you go to the mattresses, you're not earning. So there's a phase where there's a consolidation or reorganization, then they realize this costs too much, then they get back to making money. There's something called the social registry, right? I mean, that's sort of a function.
It's funny that you mentioned that, because before I got online today, I looked up the Prince of Eisenberg. I was just curious. Prince of Eisenberg and Rothschilds.
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, the hereditary Prince of Eisenberg married somebody by the name of Sophie, and then Sophie is related to Hannah Rothschild.
Yeah.
So just doing a little internet search, I came up with that.
And also, I mean, look at it. I mean, look at, like, these families. A good example is whether it's what's his name at CNN?
Wolf Blitzer?
No, the gay guy.
Oh, yeah, Anderson Cooper.
Right? Anderson. Yeah, Anderson. He's the
This is not a family show, is it?
Anderson and the Pooper. No, but anyway, getting childish here. But yeah, I mean, was it Vanderbilt family, CIA?
Yeah.
So you have wealth, intelligence agencies. Like, okay, and I found out a while back that MTV. What was that host? She used to do a show. She was a host on one of those MTV shows in the 90s, and she traces back to an old Jewish banking family. I forget her name. I can't. But the whole point is, again, you have all these media figures that we're given, that we're supposed to listen to and follow and emulate and care about what they think and what they say. They have this connection to these families. So even the system itself is rigged John Adams at Hoaxbusters, well, he's talked about the family, the elite links of all these ties to all these so-called celebrities, not being discovered in a drug, you know, on a stool in a drugstore in middle America somewhere or in Hollywood. They all have these connections, you know, so it's...
Right, and the ones that aren't in the family bloodlines are just controlled, fully compromised people.
Yeah, Molly Cyrus. Excuse me, Molly Cyrus's family. I think her grandfather or great uncle was a member of the Federal Reserve Board.
Wow.
So, you know, so maybe that's why her father was able to be successful with a couple songs and then set her daughter, his daughter up. And then you have, I think is Katy Perry's father is some like mega church operator or something. You know, which is ties back to Zionism.
And then they have all these military connections, you know.
Yeah.
It's constant.
Dave McGowan's research regarding this stuff is, you know.
Yeah.
And the same thing apparently is true in across the pond in the UK with Tavistock and some of these, like the Rolling Stones being tied to London School of Economics. It's a Fabian society operation. And the Beatles ties to Tavistock and these things and EMI and just the musical influence in these things, all military industrial complex related. And then, you know, if you think about it, entertainment, these things, culture, these things aren't going to be left alone to develop on their own. They're going to be manipulated by the oligarchs because the arts have always been used as a weapon by oligarchs, going back to the days of, you know, ancient Greece.
You know, I think that a lot of people kind of figured it out. The Rothschilds, once they emerged, they kind of got that part. But I don't think people really realize what went into that. What was the stew? What was the brew that created that system?
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of it could be found in the Sabbatean Frankist movement.
Yeah,
it was bigger than people realize, more widespread, more influential. They tended to get key positions. They were great infiltrators. They used every scheme and every trick in the book through sex, seduction, compromise. I mean, I don't know. I don't know how they did it, but they did it.
Well, this is the model for today's intelligence agencies. You've cited, I've interviewed a couple times, and you've cited the research of George Webb, who talks about the Brownstone operations, and there's like a training manual how to do this with like $10,000. He says you can take over a country within 5 years.
Right, right,
you know,
right. That's really a revelation, and that's true. I'm sure that's how they did it.
You know,
that's how they were doing it in the 18th century, and they had the clubs, they had hellfire, they had people kind of changing their outlook.
Yeah.
Lots of foils.
And this is why we look at modern, whether it's the current, what we had with Pizzagate or the revelations regarding Speaker of the House, Denny Hastert. I mean, this guy did not become Speaker of the House despite being a pedophile. He became Speaker of the House because he was a pedophile.
Right. It's all stupidity. You know, it doesn't have anything to do with malice. Oh, no. Just no. La-di-da.
Or even the
Occam's razors. Everything's real simple and everybody's stupid.
I mean, we're not supposed to draw any conclusion to the fact that, you know, the guy Epstein is flying around with the, you know, former Prime Minister of Israel, President Clinton, Donald Trump, you know, and his mansion is wired for audio visual, just like Craig Spence's house was in Washington, D.C. with the Franklin scandal and these things. And we get glimpses of this stuff because every once it gets reported in the news, I think you've cited in your article the Mark Dutroux affair and how that tied back to Israeli intelligence. The same thing with Epstein. You know,
right.
So it's all about control, getting a control file, and this through sexual, you know, use sex to subvert.
Well, now they can do it on just on everybody. You know, back in the Sabbatean days, it might have been a little tougher. You had to target, you know, through the Freemasonry. Okay, let's target this guy. Let's target this key guy. Now they can just do it to anybody.
Well, then you couldn't put it on film.
Yeah,
and that's nothing. When I got to talk, subverting society is. You're talking. Well, one thing you made a point about, you can get away with a lot if you're willing to do a lot of bad things, because most people simply cannot relate to that level of depravity. That one thing is they're incredulous when they hear stories because they don't think something like this can really go on. Another thing is there's the benefit to being just simply audacious with your violence. And we see that portrayed in mob movies sometimes, you know, where the mobster would just intimidate everyone with just sheer violence. And people, because the vast majority of people are decent, but they're not organized. But you have a small clique that is well organized, got their act together.
And crazy. Well, and crazy. Really crazy behavior. And get away with it because they have a lot of power, a lot of control.
Yeah. And we see in these movies about how judges and the police and politicians are all corrupt. They're in league with these mobsters. And just it's not just the Sicilians that are doing this. It's obviously this is a model that they're basing it on. And other crime syndicates do this. And, of course, there's a reason why we don't hear... We hear a lot about Al Capone, but we don't hear much about, you know, things like characters like well, we do hear a little bit, but we don't really get the truth of the power of one like Meyer Lansky or Mo Dow.
Yeah, or the Red Mafia that came over from Russia, the Russian Jewish mob that came over in the 1990s. You know, all the movies are made to show white Caucasian Russian guys.
Yeah.
Well, that's the muscle. That's all they are.
Yeah. And the oligarchs were actually working for agents for the City of London during the rape of Russia in the 90s. And they were rewarded with becoming billionaires for raping Russia, the takedown of Russia. And, you know, that's why I was talking with Richard Spence about how the Russian Revolution was kind of an earlier phase of that, where it was just seen as an emerging market you could exploit. And you definitely don't want it to develop on its own, because that becomes a competing source of power to the Anglo-American Zio Empire. And you saw that occur in Russia today, which is probably explains a lot of the propaganda regarding Russia right now, being promoted by the neocons, by Congressman Schiff, which is an interesting name considering the role that Jacob Schiff played. I don't know if they're related, but it's interesting.
You think they want to work Russia over again, just do another crisis and work them over?
They're trying to do something like that. I don't know to what extent that. I think Russia itself is heavily infiltrated. I don't think how it couldn't be. From what I understand, is like the Russian central bank is very Anglophile, and characters like Putin are battling with that. I don't know, but then again, I don't know to what extent there's any true independence in the world. I think anything, there's power blocks and factions that are competing, and you might get some resistance from China and Russia in these things. But even China itself has worked over the coals for more than a century, by the Rockefellers, and China now is sort of like a Rockefeller wet dream of what a society should look like, a bunch of workers and factories making crap for the world.
Right. No, and the United States is just basically going to be a beta test for this parasite guild operation. Uh-huh. It's a perfect country to loot. A lot of debt.
Yep.
And sort of a flaccid people that are very unaware of what's happening. Perfect.
Yeah, they're beguiled or they're entertained in their stupor, and they don't. And of course, they're not really taught. The media, the academic institutions, the media institutions don't provide them any information to make sense of the world.
And the whole gun thing, gun control. I think that's nonsense. They don't want to do that. They'll take the guns when the time comes. But meanwhile, they want to keep everybody armed because that kind of keeps the right flavor, the right fear level.
Well, that also that I think a lot of that these psychological operations. Again, this gets back to this. They love to pull the wool over people's eyes and hoodwink people, which is sort of a Masonic principle, but fooling the public, some of these weird...
So when I was going through this description of the Sabbateans, were you seeing the Masonic corollaries?
A lot.
Going through all that?
A lot of overlap. I think that the fact that it's some of it could date far back to some sort of esoteric understanding of things, but also it's an organizing principle to engage in high-level criminality and malevolence without getting caught. And there's been scholarly works on that, at least the role of Freemasonry. The British Empire was a Freemasonic project. And then, Jessica, was it Harlan Jacobs wrote a book about the Freemasonry, the Builders of Empire, about Freemasonry?
So it seems like these Francis are just a natural corollary just to tie into this system.
Yeah.
Maybe not the front line of it, but a natural spy network and somebody to kind of plug into and also to put the inverted morals into the system.
Yeah, that gets an inversion, which is a principle of Luciferianism and Satanism. You invert moralism. Transvaluation, which you see with this, where you turn the bad good and the good bad. And obviously we're seeing that today with modern, a lot of things with transgenderism and the sexual revolution and the weapon, sort of this militant gay rights activism.
These Frankists could have just written a book on that.
Yeah. Where if you, good example, you want to just, if you're a normie, and you just take a step back and maybe if you're 50 years old and you're a normie, you have some 50 or 60 years old, like you and I, you were in that age. We remember an earlier time where, you know, where the pedestrian morality, the average typical public morality was different, where that's been actually been inverted to being evil. Because if you have any semblance of idea of sexual morality and decency, you're labeled a homophobe, a transphobe, a bigot for adhering to some sense of sexual morality or discipline. And if you look askance at degenerate behavior and the promotion of it, degenerate behavior, you are labeled intolerant. I don't know if you caught how insane the system is. I related the story to Joe a couple of days ago on our show that there was a young lady I was talking to, and her son, she's brought in the counseling, 6-7 year old boy, having trouble with his teacher, and he apparently called his teacher a fag. And turns out his teacher is a transvestite. And this guy comes in dressed as a woman, and he's entrusted with 7-year-old children and teaching them. And she tells the school, I'll tell him not to call him names, but I can't tell him to respect him because we're Catholic and we believe this is wrong. But okay, that's that. Now, this raises a few questions. One thing is, what type of institution is this woman trusting to, you know, teach her children, to have her child 6-7 hours a day, that would indulge, not just indulge, but promote a transvestite over, you know, and then wonder why, and when the kid calls this guy who obviously has a psychological disorder a name, and they think that the problem is with the kid, not with the transvestite.
Yeah, the term I've come up with is pervert justice warriors.
Yeah, yeah.
You got a bunch of pervert justice warriors that are running these institutions,
and they're indignant. I mean, they become self-righteous about degenerate behavior.
Right.
You know, much more so than any moralist, you know, of a previous era.
The social justice warriors that kind of get, but the pervert justice warriors is just the bridge too far.
But it's the ultimate inversion, right? And this gets back to this Crowleyan method of inversion and these things. And that gets in this whole the importance of sodomy in these things. How you convert, you take the fertile, turn it sterile in these things. So there's a deeper philosophical justification for some of these things. That's why an excuse to engage in degenerate, you know, sinful, disgusting behavior, you know, to have a party. But ultimately, perhaps there's some sort of, you know, spiritual dimension to this that they're promoting.
Clearly, because just sinning alone, that doesn't explain it all.
Yeah.
That's the entree to let you just go ahead and get power, because that's their stated goal, world dominance. That's the stated goal of these Frankists. It's in their writings.
Yeah, and it's interesting they'd have the eye, which is the all-seeing eye, and this is the New World Order. And then you get into this whole, like I mentioned to you off call, that this is the with the spy and, you know, master spy, they called him, but Sidney Reilly called, you know, the occult octopus. And what we're seeing today is this whole, the global monoculture promoting all this stuff. And obviously, if you have traditional societies, there are firewalls to this stuff. They're impediments to global monoculture.
Well, the Frankists wanted it compulsory. They used the term compulsory world system in on this inversion that they created. Well, I mean, what a horrific world.
Well, that's
what it's coming to,
yeah,
too.
Compulsory, and it was, I think it was, wasn't the son of Paul Wahlberg in the 1940s who testified, as he said this in the U.S. Senate. I forget his first name, one of the Wahlbergs. Wouldn't be surprised if they're Sabbatean, but he said, we will have world government, whether by consent or force, but we will have it.
Yeah. Where did they get that idea?
And so when you have a scion from a powerful family like the Wahlbergs talking about world government, and then if you're trying to warn people about world government, you're called a conspiracy theorist. But he said it.
I know. Well, I mean, you know, Zig Brzezinski, I wrote an article on him. Same thing, just in his book. He just lays it right out there for everybody to see. That's what I said in the opener. I found this Brzezinski quote. Okay. This is from the Technotronic era.
This is Brzezinski.
Brzezinski.
Brzezinski, yeah. Okay.
He says, the nation state is a fundamental unit of man's organized life, has ceased to be the principal creative force. International banks and multinational corporations are acting and planning in terms that are far in advance of the political concept of the nation state. Well, that's just opening yourself up to being a cattle. You're going to be you're going to have an emergency, which they're going to create, which you just kind of ran through exactly how they do it. Mm-hmm. You're not going to have anybody to fall back on because you have no kin, you have no state, you have nobody caring about your countrymen. It's all been abdicated to these Sabbatean Frankists.
And this is why, companies
doing anything they want to you.
Yeah, and the companies like Walmart and, we're all working at a Walmart or Amazon distribution center or something,
So that's the Brzezinski vision of the world. He's probably a Polish noble. His ancestors were probably Polish nobles working with the Frankists there in Poland on some of the innkeeping. Alcohol distribution.
I mean, so we have statements from Brzezinski, who's a national security advisor to Jimmy Carter, who's his sort of the handler for Carter. He worked Chris Brzezinski, promoted by David Rockefeller, the Trilateral Commission, which is openly stated about this kind of, they set this up, this sort of this, this transnational cosmopolitan view of the world. And so he's promoted by, because he came out of Columbia, but he's promoted by David Rockefeller. Of course, it was Kissinger, who was Nixon's handler, who opened up China. Right.
And Brzezinski's bloodline is probably pretty nasty, because these black Polish nobility were not nice people.
No.
He doesn't come from a good bloodline either. You know? No. They're not picking these people up from Kansas State anymore. It's Iowa State,
No, not from the Midwest.
We're not in Kansas anymore. Yeah. That's the best statement I can make.
So, Russ, anything else you want
to... No, that's good. I'm glad I got this off my chest.
Good for now. I mean, I know your website a lot. So, your website, the New Nationalist, right?
Mm-hmm. NewNationalist.net.
.net. Go there. You post articles daily. Got a lot there. Very provocative. I'd like to have you back on, talk about something more specific items you have up there at some point in the future.
Absolutely. Enjoyed it.
So great. I'll let you go. Enjoy the rest of your afternoon. And okay. When I post this, I'll probably post this in a couple of days. When I do, I'll send you the link.
Okay. Thanks, Tim. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
For you, don't mistake my love for. Thank you.